Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 30th of May. This will be our last show of May. Oh, my goodness. Just think of that. 5 months that we have done for this calendar year 2025. And we're finishing up the month of May. That's one little thing to note. The second thing to note is it's also our last show until ? We don't know when our next show is going to be. We would love to tell you it's going to be this day or that day or it'll be on Monday, but we can't tell you that because we're going to be doing the fun drive. The fun drive begins 6 a.m. on Monday morning. Now, we would love to say we'll be here, and we're going to be here anyway. So here's the point. Whenever you all get together and decide that it's time to end the fun drive, we will be here, we'll put a show together, and it'll be on the air in absolute no time. So, and that's all of the programs. That's not just ours. That's any of the programs that you listen to and the things that you pledge for throughout the drive. So we I had someone in this room yesterday actually say to me, so what do you just hold that programming hostage? And I said, well, no. What we do is we try to make the money so we can actually do those shows. That's what
it feels like a thriller the way you said it.
That's right. That's what we're trying to do. And so if everyone came through this morning, then there would be we're done. We're ready. So it's an opportunity. And Ian and Sarah will be back in a little bit. They've got challenges on the table and all kinds of things going on. And I look, we got to make it happen so we can get back. There's just too much news. There's too much happening in the world. And I plead with you, do whatever you can, and we'll be back as soon as possible. So our next show will be in June, but as to what day, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. A couple of announcements that I would like to make. I real quickly want to introduce everybody, so if they speak, you'll know who is talking. And I don't mean they'll be speaking during the show. I meant during the introduction. But here we go. Malia Dumont is with us. I haven't seen Malia in a while. It seems like a dog's year, but I am thrilled that she is with us. Malia is Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's been a very busy month with commencement. We made it through. And I just want to say about this day, May 30th, it's also significant because for the first time in 1868, for the 100 years until 1968, May 30th was celebrated as Memorial Day.
That's right.
In this country. And then it was enshrined in law as the fourth Monday in May. But for many years, it was always May 30th. And in some communities, it's still observed on May 30th, including Saugerties, New York, where I will be speaking tonight at the Memorial Day ceremony. And so if folks are interested in that, it's going to be 6 p.m. at 30 John Street in Saugerties. It's an event that's co-hosted by the local American Legion Post and the local VFW Post in Saugerties.
These celebrations in the communities are so meaningful and so wonderful as you see the community come together and realize realize the sacrifice of each of these towns. And a wonderful asset, of course, to have you speak. So that's wonderful. 6 o'clock tonight in Saugerties.
Exactly.
Terrific. We also welcome Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of Illiberal Vanguard, Popular Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich is with us. Good morning, Alexander. How are you?
I'm doing well, recovering the best I can from a dental procedure yesterday.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry.
I'm fine.
Okay.
You know, it's coming along, but...
Are you numb or is it pain?
Some marginal pain.
Okay.
You know,
but, all right.
It's already receding, thankfully.
Yeah. So. Well, if you need help, I think Aaron would probably be the best person. But Aaron, we can just send him out into the avenue. I think he could probably get something for your pain. Bring right back
in. Well, I'm going to do some shopping at the local food stores, the international markets on this block. Mm-hmm. So that's my form of...
We'll take a walk down Quail Street when we're finished.
And that's a really mean statement, but I only said that because your tattoos are showing today.
I know. I've got away with words and people. You know?
I think you could broker this deal. Alexander, good luck with the oral issues. Yes. We welcome Aaron Pasitti to the program, professor of economics at Siena College. Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well.
I haven't seen you in a while either.
Yeah. I was here 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
You were, but that's, you know, so it goes. I'm excited.
You seem it.
Because everybody gets to say goodbye to Elon Musk today.
Yes, yes, it's the
it's a sad day.
It's the press conference that'll be happening at 1:30, and the I'm sure there'll be a cake.
Is somebody going to jump out of the cake?
That'll be great. Yeah. It'll be absolutely terrific. All right, a couple things I want to mention before we get into the news of the day. First of all, we have a WAMC Super Premium. This is an exclusive Lockbox Premium that is coming up, and this is going to be happening on Tuesday, so time is of the essence. If you want this, you're going to have to call for it, 1-800-323-9262. Don't worry, I will give that number about 500 more times. So, WAMC On the Road invites you to meet Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. Richard Russo is from Gloversville, New York. He writes about Saratoga. He writes about Gloversville. He writes about Maine. His new book is called Life and Art. It is an essay collection. It is absolutely gorgeous. I finished it last night. I had read the life part, and now I have read the art part, and it is just stunning. It is a great chronicle of our times that we live in, and for a man in his early 70s sort of coming to terms with the life that he has led, with how his country has changed. And it is fascinating and beautifully written, as it always is when Richard Russo is behind the pen. So Richard Russo will be at a special pre-book event reception for WAMC VIP guests Tuesday, June 3rd at 5:30 at the White Hart in Salisbury, Connecticut. If you would like to be one of those VIP special guests, all you have to do is call us. It's a pledge of $100 for a sustaining membership, and we would love to have you with us. Again, we only have 7 of these left, and so it's going to be a very small group of people in the room, and we're going to talk, and that's at 5:30. Then there will be the actual interview. I'll be interviewing Richard for a taping of the book show at 6:30, and all of this at the White Hart in Salisbury, Connecticut, which is one of the most beautiful places on earth. Space is limited, so please, if you would like to attend, all you got to do is call us, 1-800-323-9262, and all of that money goes into the Lockbox, and we need that desperately as well. So please, if you're interested in that, 1-800-323-9262. Two other WAMC On the Road events I just want to mention real quickly. First of all, Rick Atkinson, the incredible historian, his second book on the American Revolution is out. He is another recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. It is the only people we allow on the air. No, Pulitzer Prize winners. Rick Atkinson's new book is called The Fate of the Day, The War for America. And it starts off in Fort Ticonderoga. It obviously includes the battle at Saratoga. And then, obviously, this particular volume 2 of this trilogy that he has written ends in Charleston in 1780. But Rick Atkinson has been working on this revolution trilogy for, I believe, over a decade. This is the latest book, and we will be tonight at the Saratoga City Center talking about this book. And if you would like to find out more information, you can go to Northshire.com. Northshire.com to find out more information about. I believe that event is just about sold out. So if you want to go, you should go there quickly to get some tickets. It is Rick Atkinson, Fate of the Day, and that is That is tonight at 6 o'clock. And then I feel like I should have a tour T-shirt up. But then I'll be in Manchester on Wednesday. We'll be in Tuesday. We'll be in Salisbury, Connecticut. Wednesday we'll be in Manchester. And we'll be talking to the amazing author Chris Bajalian, who is one of Vermont's, one of the great Vermonters, an amazing author who has a stunning number of best-selling books. And his latest is called The Jackal's Mistress. And Chris Bajalian, Chris is a friend. Chris is somebody I just love talking to. We've done this many, many times. And I have just a blast chatting with him. Chris Bajalian will be in conversation at Northshire in Manchester at 6 o'clock on Wednesday, June 4th. And you can find out more information about that event by going to northshire.com. So the one that really impacts us is the event for Richard Russo. And if you would like tickets to the VIP event and help the Lockbox, WAMC.org, but even better, in fact, the only way you can do it is to go online, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC, and we only have 7 of those, and I would hope by the end of this time together we are done, and everyone will have their tickets to go and to join us for little appetizers, a little charcuterie. Some drink or two. We'll chat. Otherwise, we'll just be bellying up to the bar and bearing our souls of our desperate lives in these desperate times. Feel free to join us for that as well. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. Okay, now let's get to the subjects at hand and what is going on in our wonderful world on this last day, our last show of May. And so Aaron, let's talk about tariffs. We'll all talk about tariffs, but I'm going to start with Aaron, and we'll get him in before the break at 9:30. But tariffs were the court said no. And then yesterday the court said, yes. So the tariffs are on for now, thanks to an appeals court in a win for Trump less than 24 hours after another court, which I still don't completely understand the Court of International Trade, but maybe you can help us with that as well. They ruled Wednesday that most of Trump's tariffs were illegal and must be halted. And then the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit said Thursday that it would temporarily pause the effects of the decision from the Court of International Trade. So we're supposed to have whiplash.
Yes, this is even tough for me to follow. So with that preface, so the justification for most of the tariffs, the reciprocal tariffs that were announced on Liberation Day, came from the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, which gives the president a fair amount of authority to regulate a lot of international economic transactions. And it arose because of the Iran hostage crisis. So it gives the president power to act without congressional approval to freeze assets, to impose regulations, to impose sanctions on countries that pose a national security threat. So that was the premise for a lot of the Liberation Day tariffs. So that's kind of the background. So if you're going to use that, Trump had to claim some type of economic and national security threat. And this is where things get beyond muddy, because he claimed that the large U.S. trade deficit was the national security threat. Well, the trade deficit has been large since the early 1980s. So I'm not sure what's new about, 2025. And it was probably the flimsiest of justifications. So I'm not surprised that the U.S. Court of International Trade, who regulates a lot of the legality surrounding trade agreements between different countries, ruled that there is no emergency. You can't do this. We have a 4.2% unemployment rate, which is the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. Inflation's come down to 2.5%. Wage growth is in excess of 3%. So it's tough to tell what economic emergency he was appealing to or using to justify these tariffs. So I'm not surprised the court ruled that he didn't have the legal authority to impose, tariffs on, islands that only have penguins on them. What is it? Hart and McDonald Islands. Tough to tell how penguins are a threat to national security, let alone some of our biggest trading partners like the EU and Canada. So there's another act, and that is the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, which gives the president to impose tariffs when imports threaten or impair our national security. So it's very similar to the Emergency Economic Powers Act, but the 1962 Trade Expansion Act is more focused on trade. So that was the justification used for a lot of the earlier tariffs, the steel and aluminum tariffs that he imposed on Canada, some tariffs on cars and car parts. But again, it's tough to see how that constitutes any type of national emergency when we've spent decades building global supply chains and a very integrated North American production system. So normally when you impose tariffs, the Secretary of Commerce does an investigation to kind of examine the details, figure out just how much of a threat it poses, what actions can be taken. That gets reviewed, that gets sent to the president. None of that was followed. Howard Lutnick just rubber stamped it and said, sure, whatever you say goes. So there was no Secretary of Commerce investigation into this. So all of these tariffs are based on really, really flimsy legality. And that's what the Wednesday ruling with the U.S. Court of International Trade said. You just can't do this. Mm-hmm. You can negotiate tariff agreements or trade agreements between individual nations as the president sees fit. But to just impose these broad-based tariffs certainly violates the legality of the law. And then yesterday, big surprise, another court came in and said, we're going to pause this ruling. So it's not ruling on the merits. It's just saying we need time to look into this. So it overturned the original Wednesday ruling.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, I have some questions about that. Then we will hear from the other members of our panel. We welcome our listeners to chime in as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm Ian Pickus.
We are here to tell you more about the Lockbox and to hopefully motivate you to donate to the station and help us shorten next week's fun drive. What'd you get up to in between our times on air, Ian?
I got a little refill. I did some audio editing. It's hard to dip in and out of your headphones, and I know you were in the same spot.
Yeah, I was also watching the line, which is what we call editing audio, watching the line.
You want us on that line, you need us on that line, and we need you. 800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. You can help us shorten the fund drive by boosting the Lockbox. We would love it to be bursting at the seams by the time the fund drive starts on Monday morning at 6 a.m. Every little bit that we raise now is an amount we do not have to do next week while regular programming is suspended.
Joe has been mentioning there is a special premium meet and greet with Richard Russo at the White Hart Inn next week. That is a $100 per month sustaining pledge if you would like to attend. 800-323-9262. You do need to call to acquire that special super premium, that sort of super plus premium, which nobody is calling it that except for me, 800-323-9262. But it is a $100 per month sustaining pledge if you would like to attend. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Currently in the lockbox, Ian, we have raised, to the generosity of so many of you out there, $432,874. An incredible sum of money. We're so grateful to have it. But the total that we need before we can return full stop to regular programming at the end of the fund drive, which is, even though this lockbox portion has been in May, it's the June fund drive, the June 2025 fund drive, which starts on Monday, is $1.25 million. We got to hit $1.25 million to get back to work.
And normally when I come into these microphones, especially in this studio, it's to deliver bad news about human depravity and disasters. Actually, I have good news to share. We got a little bit of a reprieve from our challenge from Claverick, Gretchen Stearns and Richard Weininger, who were going to give us $1,000 if we could make it to the $435,000 point by 9:30. Well, we didn't make it by 9:30, but they are giving us until 10 to cash that $1,000 check on top of it. So this morning, if you were thinking about making a lockbox pledge and you didn't get around to doing it while we were on air earlier, we have about 27 extra minutes, and we would love to hear from you this morning for any amount. If you can do $5, great. If you want to do something like $5,000, boy, that would go a long way too.
1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. We have heard from people this morning, of course. That is why the total is going up. So let me thank Lois in Saratoga Springs, your hometown.
Hometown.
Anonymous of New York, New York. Actually, this is Candida from Bolton Landing. Well, that's confusing, but I get it.
Did you say Candida?
Candida.
Cool.
It could be Candida.
Could be.
From Bolton Landing, loves Book Picks and Vox Pop. Thanks to Suzanne in South Deerfield, Roberta in Altamont, Catherine in Red Hook, Anonymous in Cahoes, Anonymous in Pittsfield, who says she listens every morning. We heard from a new member, Michael in Saratoga Springs, who says, I look forward to my morning cup of coffee with Joe. That's from Mick. And we also heard from Robert in Cahoes, who says, thank you for being there. 800-323-9262.
One cup? One morning cup?
Well, maybe they have one morning cup of coffee with one person, and then another with another person, and another with another person. 800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. My father has morning coffee, friends.
Really?
He does. And he did in Saranac Lake, and now he lives in Tennessee, and he made another one, and they just come over in the morning and have coffee and gab, and I think it is wonderful. Male loneliness epidemic where? 1-800-323-9262.
Can I make a snobby question comment?
Sure.
Is it instant coffee?
It's not instant coffee.
Because that would scan with Kim.
It would, but it is. He actually has fallen for JFG Coffee, which is a roastery in Knoxville.
Okay.
He buys a local roastery. And,
great.
Yeah, it's drip coffee.
Cool. Yeah, that's all you need.
Of course. 800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. We've just crossed over into the $433,000 point in the lockbox.
$2,000 to go.
$433,024. It is imperative that we return you to the roundtable panel. 800-323-9262. Please help us make this challenge, which, tell me the details of the challenge one more time, Ian, before we pop over to the panel.
We got 1G on the table from Gretchen Stearns and Richard Weininger from Claverick, New York. If we can make it to the $435,000 point by 10 o'clock, they gave us a little extra time. I think they felt bad that my first day of lockbox pitching had fallen short, and they don't want me to get into a tailspin today. So we appreciate that. We're going to make it to 435 by 10 o'clock, and we'll be in great shape to have a short June fun drive. That's what this is all about, at a time when we have, you know, really never needed you more.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And thanks to both Ian and Sarah for their great job and getting the phones to ring. 1-800-323-9262 and have folks go to their devices and to help fill the lockbox. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Perhaps you just heard the underwriting announcement from our Dina Salzman, who was reading that. And that was about the event I was talking about earlier with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. I just want to make sure that you all know the pledge amount is $100 per month, sustaining membership for a pair of tickets. So that's how that works. So it's not 100 even, it's 100 for a sustaining membership. So just so you know that, I wanted to make that clear. And again, the event is Tuesday, June 3rd at 5:30 at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut. And you must call the station to claim, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. All right, let's go back to the when last we left. In our last segment, Aaron Bissetti was telling us about the back and forth nature of court action and tariffs. And I believe we got up to the point where the court acted yesterday and said, okay, we're going to, while this court said that this is illegal, we are now going to look at this. But while we look at this, the tariffs are allowed to continue.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, just out of curiosity, wouldn't it be easier to just say, and I don't know the answer to this, that's why I'm asking you, we're going to figure this out, and if it is illegal, maybe we won't do it. We'll just keep it the way it is until we find out whether it is or not.
It's,
or doesn't it work like that?
It's not with Trump. The policy changes by the day, right? There was the
but I mean the court.
The court.
I mean, as far as the court saying that, I mean, the court could have said, okay, we are going to, we want this to go back to the to another court to investigate, right? Mm-hmm. And but we will allow the hold to stay in place until we investigate.
But the tariffs have, I mean, the tariffs haven't been deemed to violate any law yet.
Okay.
So I think that's why they're allowed. So I think that's why they are allowed to remain in place.
Allowed to continue.
Yeah.
Okay.
A question though, Aaron. I mean, are the tariffs actually being applied already, or is there a waiting period? I thought that
there was
the
a pause.
Court has to. Yeah. There's a pause of about 2 weeks before the matter is actually settled.
Right.
Is that correct?
And then there's the 90-day pause that Trump put into effect once bond markets started tanking in early April. So keeping track of what's in effect where, with whom and where is head spinning.
Right. As are the complexities of this whole matter.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, just in terms of Trump's own coalition, because one of the organizations that stepped forward to oppose the tariffs, these particular tariffs, is the Liberty Justice Center, which is a libertarian organization. Among other people, Rand Paul has been very supportive of. And so if you look at the court order, it's a kind of a head spinning, talk about head spinning, agglomeration of states, multiple states in the union are, supporting this stay of the tariffs, in addition to all sorts of companies. There's a plastics company, there's a wine importing company, perhaps not altogether surprisingly, given how they would be affected by the tariffs, and a couple of other companies, sort of small corporations, and so there's that aspect of it that's sort of interesting, the way this all shows up the fissures within Trump's coalition. The other thing I just want to, and this is kind of a sort of a sidebar, but the title of the article in the Post was "Tariffs are on for now thanks to appeals court in win for Trump." This is, among recent things that I've read in the press, this is one of the times where I'm especially struck by the gap between the article's title and the actual content.
Uh-huh.
This is the Washington Post. This is not really a win for Trump. I mean, it's a stay. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
well, let's remember who owns the Washington Post and what some of his recent editorial.
Jeff Bezos, who has, let's say, a bit of an axe to grind in terms of mollifying the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, that's something that also, again, this is a sidebar, but there's something to think about.
My turn.
Yeah. Your turn.
Whiplash is one thing. So I think from sort of a larger perspective, this illustrates the overall strategy, once again, of the Trump administration, which is to both justification shop and venue shop when they're trying to just impose a number of different actions for the administration to take, especially in the area of international affairs, whether it's increased deportations or I know we're going to get to some of these other topics this morning, how international students are managed in the United States to these tariffs and just this extraordinarily broad view of presidential power. And they will take it everywhere they can, as far as they can. So whether the original justification is, as Aaron pointed out, flimsy on its surface, then they'll refine it. They'll see how the courts respond. But I think the sort of the strategy is to take action as quickly as possible and then refine the response based on how the legal system tries to manage that. Mm-hmm. And the legal system is trying to deal with all these things. It's by design and by procedure, it's slower than an executive type authority is. And so I think we're going to continue to see in a number of areas, headlines where a Trump administration takes action X, and then people may sort of be like, oh no, or how, what are the consequences of that? Or and just a lot of confusion and concern about the implications, the consequences of that. And then the courts will weigh in a little bit later, and there may be a stay, there may be a pause, there may not be a pause, and so I think it's very it becomes even more difficult for the average citizen to follow what's going on and understand the implications. So one of the things I've been thinking about is just sort of imagining if I were the managing editor of the New York Times, how would I manage my newsroom in this situation? I mean, it seems like you really need to restructure. You need to pull in people who have kinds of expertise that haven't been as necessary in previous years. Because so many actions are being taken throughout the executive branch that are not readily apparent, but they have wide-reaching implications. And if you don't have people sort of assigned to who really understand, the federal government or the court system, if you don't have people assigned to watch those things specifically, then it's just not going to get out there. And so I know there are a lot of things happening throughout the executive branch that have wide-reaching implications that just aren't rising to the level of headline. And it's not only because only the most potentially devastating headlines like these tariffs are making it to the sort of top of the front page, but I think it's also because newsrooms, and I'm not saying this as a knock on the media, I'm just sort of observing what I think is the truth. I think newsrooms are not as well equipped as we need in this moment to sort of follow the details of where these policies are actually being implemented and what their effects might be.
Aaron?
I think Malia's right, and I also think that's part of the broader strategy of just what Steve Bannon's muzzle velocity phrase. The interesting thing here is that, remember, Trump has a Republican Congress. There would have been, it would be very easy to pass a broader piece of legislation through Congress regarding international trade policy, not this haphazard, have ChatGPT figure out what reciprocal tariffs look like and then have a poster board that nobody can read in the Rose Garden. But, that's not his style. So there's three issues that I want to really address, because we can talk about the legal rulings and what this does and what that does. And the first thing that this accomplishes or fails to accomplish is that businesses can deal with higher costs, whether it's Amazon, whether it's General Motors, whether it's a smaller mom-and-pop hardware store. Businesses can easily adjust to higher costs. They can take lower profit margins. They can raise prices. They can figure out ways to improve productivity and efficiency. What businesses... So tariffs are not a major issue for businesses, provided they're not, you know, 200% or something. What businesses can adapt to and what poses the bigger threat to the U.S. economy, and what a lot of policymakers like Jerome Powell at the Federal Reserve and others are saying, is that the biggest risk to the economy is the uncertainty. Businesses can't deal with uncertainty, right? So if you're building a high-rise apartment building in New York City and it's half complete, do you buy more steel now? Do you wait? Do you put it on pause and wait 2 years, hoping that the tariffs get overruled and that the tariffs are out? So the uncertainty, whether it's with consumers, not knowing if car prices are going to be 25% higher next year, do you buy now? Do you wait? When consumers and businesses face uncertainty, they freeze. They just stop and wait for the waters to clear and then make action in the future. But when that happens, that slows economic activity, and that's a big reason that a lot of people are forecasting a recession. The other issue is the whole concept of the trade deficit as a threat to the U.S. economy is nonsense. I run a trade deficit with Stewart's. I give them a lot of my money, and they don't give me any money back. But I get goods and services from Stewart's. I run a trade deficit with Home Depot and Lowe's, because when I go there to buy stuff, I give them my money, and they don't give me any money back. But they do give me goods and services. It's the same principle with international trade. We give other countries money, and they give us things that we either can't produce ourselves, like, say, coffee or, I don't know, not semiconductors, other types of, you know, produce. And then we supply them with things that they can't make. That's the whole logic of free trade. And that's why you see libertarian organizations, including, I found myself nodding my head in the few days after Liberation Day, agreeing with the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, being like, yeah, this is disastrous. You can say what you want about free trade and libertarians and how it's approached, but it's the uncertainty issue. If the goal is to, as Trump states, to bring back manufacturing jobs, there's other ways to do that. Biden's CHIPS Act was a good example, right? You have industrial policy and federal spending that incentivizes domestic production. Just making foreign goods more like taxing cars and semiconductors doesn't mean that all of a sudden by the end of 2025, we're going to have 1,000 new car plants and semiconductor plants. Those take years, if not decades, to build. You have to, you know, source products, get supply chains in order. That's just a fantasy. And that brings me to the third topic, which is, then what is he doing? What's the ultimate goal here? And I know, I mean,
which brings me to the third topic. What the hell is going on?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I use different language at home.
Sure. But we all do.
So, I mean, listen, Scott Bessent and Lutnick both know this is not going to work. This is going to create a lot of economic uncertainty. There's a couple of hypotheses. There's the conspiratorial one, which is the taco trade, that if you look at stock markets, he announces tariffs, they drop. He says tariffs are off. They come back up. It looks like a taco shell.
Right.
That there might be some insider trading going on, not with him specifically, but with his network and tentacles of
the
firms.
The orbit.
Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, so working on that taco acronym, Trump always chickens out. He's lost all of the leverage he claims to have had once he backed off of the tariffs after Liberation Day. So he is in a far weaker position to negotiate anything, which brings me to the third topic. And this is what I think, or the third hypothesis, which is, I think what he's really doing. This is just a dominance display. This is a silverback gorilla thumping his chest to get world leaders to come to the White House and give them a public dressing down so he can appear, appear strong and then claim victory for some mild, insignificant accomplishment.
Isn't that the sort of a priori situation to begin with?
Yeah, no, it is. Right. So, but when people are like, but we haven't talked about tariffs since 1930 when, you know, Smoot-Hawley was in place. And then going back to your comments about newsrooms, nobody talked about tariffs. There were no tariff reporters. You had people monitoring international trade and economic activity, but like the concept of tariffs and U.S. Court of International Trade, these are things that have not come up in the past, you know, couple decades.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we have Malia Dumond, Alexander Mihailovic, and Aaron Pasitti making up the group. This morning we are talking about tariffs. And, you know, Aaron, you were saying this confuses even me, and you're an economist. And I think a lot of us are feeling confusion, a lot of us going back and forth. Does the confusion help or hurt the Trump administration effort?
That's a good question. I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth here. It helps the Trump administration because it provides a distraction for more nefarious things they might be up to. So you can look at this as just a distraction from, I don't know, deporting people to South Sudan, right? That this is a more innocuous way to get the news media's eyes away from that. But I think... And you're already starting to see consumer sentiment plunge. You're seeing business confidence plunge because of the uncertainty. This is going to destroy Republicans in the 2026 midterm. So does it help Trump and the Trump administration in the short term? Yes, by distracting people and the news media from other issues. In the longer term, the effect this is going to have on the economy, I think, whether or not people believe tariffs work, Trump's not going to be able to deny once grocery prices start going up and car prices start going up and the light manufactured goods we ordered from Amazon start going up. So once that hits, which a lot of economists say will take time, probably later this summer, early this fall, I think that's going to really, really hurt the Trump administration.
When I want to get to some listener letters here as well, and but I also, we don't know, this decision came very quickly from when the appeal was filed. So is there any sense as to when this will?
No, it'll probably end up going to the Supreme Court. To be perfectly honest, I don't fully understand. Everything happened so fast. I don't fully understand the legal channels through which this has to progress before it's ultimately resolved. And I have a feeling you're probably going to see different courts ruling differently, at which point it will go to the Supreme Court. And then it becomes a whole separate issue about the legality of it. So, no, I have no idea.
Alexander?
I think there are a couple of things here to sort of think about. One is that apparently on the Court of International Trade, there's at least one Trump appointee, and that particular appointee voted indeed that the Trump's tariffs were unjustified. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of interesting. Again, you know, getting back to the whole matter of, you know, there is a kind of an almost self-destructive aspect to all of this. And here I just want to point out very quickly two things. One, as Aaron, as you pointed out, Congress is now dominated by the Republicans. If Trump just followed what the Constitution says, he could have gone to Congress and they would have approved this. But no, he actually went and he said, we don't need Congress's approval anyway. Let me just go straight and do this. Now, if this goes to the Supreme Court, it's going to be a very interesting discussion there because, there are a couple of people there who on paper are, constitutional literalists, of the Antonin Scalia variety, specifically, Alito and Clarence Thomas. But I think more palpably at this point, Amy Coney Barrett. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that she would vote against this kind of measure, this kind of action on the part of the chief executive. So we'll see what happens. But I think that's going to be, I have a sense that it would not be approved by the Supreme Court.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation, move on to other topics, and have much more to discuss on this Friday morning. Aaron Pasitti, Alexander Mihailovich, and Malia DeMont with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuc.
I'm Ian Pickus.
And we made the last Lockbox challenge that had been presented to us. Thank you to all of you out there who've called in or gone online this morning and pledged. It is so important. It's the only way we can stay on the air. It's the only way we can bring you the news and entertainment that you are looking for from your public radio station. And you're showing up, and we're so glad, but let's keep it rolling.
And thank you so, so much to Gretchen Stearns and from Richard Weininger from Claverick, New York, who helped us out with that $1,000 lockbox challenge. You know, doing the lockbox in the morning and, you know, doing it the way we're doing it ahead of the fun drive, we want to keep the station on the air, and having people who give challenges to help support the station and who make a pledge, who call in with any amount, it's really gratifying, and it helps us keep this thing moving in the right direction. We can't do it without you. Thank you for the challenge, and thanks to everybody who met the challenge.
This is the moment to step up, not just as a listener, but as someone who believes in the role that public radio plays in a healthy democracy. WAMC is here for you every day, offering fact-based journalism, thoughtful conversations, and a community of curious and informed voices. But that can only happen because listeners like you support it. Because listeners like you support it.
Export it.
Export it. Import it. Speaking of tariffs, 800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. The programming provided to you is vitally important to you. And how do I know that? You tell us. You tell us all the time. We get email throughout the year. We get buoying and complimentary and disappointed comments throughout the fun drive. We take it all. We need to know. We are not beyond feedback, of course. But through all of that and through your passionate responses and donations, we know that it matters to you. If you want to keep WAMC on the air for you and future generations and return us to regular programming as quickly as possible next week, you have to give now. That's the only way to do it.
1-800-323-9262. You can be a sustaining member. You can help keep WAMC uninterrupted. And you can make a pledge at this time when we know public media is in the crosshairs. The federal government is moving to take funding back from stations like ours, from the entire system. And that is going to have an impact. Whatever you think of the policy idea of it, it is going to have an impact on what is able to be offered to you. And as I said earlier, this news doesn't just happen. It takes a lot of people working really hard and with dedication on a daily basis. The roundtable panel, that show does not just happen. That is a 3-hour juggernaut. You've got to schedule panelists. You've got to find experts. You've got to deal with schedules. You've got to look at subject matter on a daily basis. You've got to be prepared to do it. And we cannot do this work without you.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. It is also important to remember and to emphasize that we have a huge fundraising goal to meet. The $1.25 million point is, of course, an intimidating sum. It's a tremendous amount of money. But through the generosity of listeners out there, we have already raised, and this is something to celebrate too, $436,811. An incredible showing. We are so grateful. We know that many of you out there pledge multiple times per fund drive, and we're hoping to convince those of you who can afford to donate to the station, who listen regularly but have yet to be convinced to pledge, to please pledge now or soon or sometime. We will keep trying to convince you.
1-800-323-9262. So many people also have begun a sustaining membership, whatever amount that they can do per month or per quarter or whatever. And that really helps us with our long-term planning. It helps the station take a look at some very choppy waters ahead and know that we're going to get through it with your support. So please do what you can. 800-323-9262. Do not take it for granted. I know that we've always had a successful fund drive because there's no alternative, but we do not want to be the ones who are here when it does fall short. That will not be a good feeling, and it will be very bad for this audience in this region.
1-800-323-9262. We'll return the airwaves proudly now back to the roundtable panel.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning, the 30th of May. We welcome you and we welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Aaron, before I let you off the hook completely in your role as our roundtable panel economist, let's talk a little bit about the meeting that took place yesterday between Donald Trump, the president of the United States, and Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve. We know that these two have been, well, certainly Trump has been sniping at Powell. Powell has tried to be, I think, take the high road as much as possible. And yet it brings this meeting. So what comes out of it?
Jerome Powell, who's the chair of the Federal Reserve System, was a Trump appointee in 2018. So let's not forget that. The Federal Reserve, without getting into the mechanics of how a central bank works, the easiest way to think about it is the Federal Reserve is an independent government agency, meaning the chair, the board of governors are appointed by the president, confirmed by Congress, and then serve staggered terms. So it's very – you can't stack – the Federal Reserve, their term, the governor's terms are 14 years. The chair's term is 4 years. So it's not like the Supreme Court where you can stack it. And the Federal Reserve serves as a check on the economic power of the president and Congress, because politicians like to pass policies that create jobs, that create income growth. They like giving out money to their constituents. They like cutting taxes. Well, all of that's good for growth and employment, but it creates inflation. So what the Federal Reserve's job is to kind of tap the brakes on the spending powers of Congress and the president if they become too aggressive. So, of course, Trump doesn't like checks on his power, so he doesn't like the Federal Reserve and he doesn't like the chair of the Federal Reserve. Trump is well aware, I think, because he said this, perhaps he's let his guard down a little bit, saying that, yeah, people are just going to have to get used to higher prices, or kids are just going to have to accept fewer dolls at Christmas, meaning he's fully aware that the tariff policy and the uncertainty that that's creating can slow growth. So what he wants Jerome Powell to do is to proactively lower interest rates, have the Federal Reserve lower interest rates to juice the economy so that Trump doesn't take the hit from his policies. In addition to that, there's the, and I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that's going through Congress, which is, in addition to being the worst named bill in U.S. congressional history, is probably also one of the cruelest in terms of slashing programs for the poor so that millionaires and billionaires can have bigger tax cuts. That's going to blow up the deficit, which has the potential to create inflation and higher interest rates. So Trump wants Jerome Powell to do his bidding, lower interest rates to juice the economy so that when Trump's policies get passed, they don't have as big a dent on economic growth and have and could potentially lead to a recession. And Jerome Powell is playing this remarkably well. I'm actually pretty impressed. When at a press conference, when a reporter asked him, will you resign if President Trump asks you to, he said no. And that was his full answer. And then the reporter said, would you elaborate on that? And he said no. So
what kind of elaboration could he make? It's pretty clear.
The president cannot fire the chair of the Federal Reserve without cause. Cause meaning malfeasance, mismanagement, insider trading. I mean, something catastrophic. And stock market, if Trump tried to fire Powell like he was talking about a while ago, I mean, you would see a worldwide recession, because then every country would lose faith in the U.S. government's ability to manage its economy. So this meeting was interesting. I would love to have been a fly on the wall, but, you know, Trump wanted Powell to lower interest rates to juice the economy to offset the negative impacts that a lot of his policies are having. And Powell said, well, the Federal Reserve bases its decisions about monetary policy and interest rate policy on incoming data, and we will see how that evolves, which is the right answer. That's what sensible people do. You look at data and see how things evolve, and the uncertainty that Trump's creating is making the Fed's job extraordinarily difficult. So earlier on, I was saying when people face uncertainty, they freeze. And that's what the Fed's doing. The Fed sees all of this policy uncertainty, tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs in court, tariffs not in court. They're just saying, well, we're going to wait and see what happens before we make any moves. And obviously Trump doesn't care for that very much. So that was the punchline. But the good news is that Trump didn't come out of this meeting in a huff threatening to fire Jerome Powell again.
That's the good
news. We'll take that. It's
admittedly a low bar, but it's still a bar nonetheless.
But the fact that this meeting took place, I mean, this is why I don't have much confidence that what you talked about before, Aaron, about the potential effects of the tariffs that we're going to see a rise in prices of good in grocery stores and appliances. We don't know exactly when, but towards the end of the summer or the fall. That's actually going to have an impact on Trump's level of popularity, like because he's obviously going to look for every avenue to obfuscate the cause behind whatever rise in prices there might be, and a lot of his supporters just find his overall decisiveness so compelling. Now, who cares that he's deciding to be cruel and cut all these social programs and cause poor people to suffer more? I mean, that it's very appealing to a lot of his base. And so I just don't see how it's going to translate as clearly into kind of a downturn for support for him as you implied
his
earlier.
His base will always be his base. There's a cult of personality issue that supersedes any type of economic or
rational thought.
Yes, sure. Thank you. That's the way. Yeah, right. But there are those very important swing voters. And I think a lot of them see this, the cruelty, the decisiveness, the machismo, whatever, and they're just getting fed up with it.
Yeah, I think that one other thing is that the grappling or locking horns with the Fed is also a kind of, or the perception of the Fed as kind of an enemy for economic growth, is has been a classic libertarian position. If you go back, also like in the early, I mean, even in the 80s, but also in the 90s, more specifically, the campaign of Ross Perot. I mean, he was carrying on about this. And, you know, both Rands, you know, Ron and, you know, Rand, you know, have also been, you know, pointing to the Fed as a kind of an almost artificial institution that is a sort of a block to sort of economic vitality. So I don't know. I mean, there's a little bit of fusionism going on here. You know, where different aspects of conservatism, the American conservative tradition, that actually don't really get along well with each other, are being brought together in some odd way.
Right.
You know, where you have coexisting this sort of boilerplate libertarian position together with this adoration of the unitary executive, which is not a libertarian position at all.
No.
So
Trump's not talking about ending the Fed.
Yeah.
Like Ron and Rand Paul were.
Right.
Trump's talking about having the Fed, like everyone else in his orbit, do whatever he says.
Right. Right.
So that
right.
goes to
but
your.
But there's kind of like bits and pieces brought together here. And it's a very strange way. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, this kind of collaging where he's trying to reach what he perceives to be as some kind of theoretical conservative vote. You know, in its like different facets.
Do you think Trump's thinking about theory?
I think he's not. I think some of his advisors are.
Sure.
And I think that there is a kind of a whole cadre of people there, you know, who've absorbed some of this, you know, among his advisors.
Project 2025 actually has a section on the Fed.
Yeah.
And it's not to eliminate the Fed.
Right.
It's to increase the amount of power the president and Congress can exert on the Fed.
Right.
Which is interesting for a proposal coming out of the Heritage Foundation. So you're right that there's this weird collage of like some libertarian thought, but also a much stronger executive branch,
right.
Which seems to be at odds with itself. But yet here we are.
Right. I think that what's going on at Harvard kind of exemplifies that, because that, too, there are all sorts of justifications for, you know, what the Trump administration is trying, the way is they're trying to penalize the university. And it's an absolute hodgepodge of different and mm-hmm. in some cases mutually, canceling out just, reasons or arguments. But we'll get to that at some point today if we can.
Maybe right now. I think there's perhaps no time like the present to talk about Harvard. If you were playing Jeopardy and the category were clearing a low bar for 400, Alec, or for Ken, I'm sorry, yeah. Poor Alex. we go to what is considered a win for Harvard University yesterday and on their graduation day of all days, but the judge blocked Trump administration effort to ban foreign students at Harvard, and students are already reporting visa denials and revocations and seeking to transfer, according to university officials. This, again, is as Harvard University celebrated their commencement exercises yesterday on the Great Lawn at Harvard. The judge's order, which was issued on commencement day, grants Harvard a win in one of the most high-stakes battles in its ongoing war with the administration. Today's court decision allows the university to continue enrolling international students and scholars while the case moves forward. Jason Newton, a spokesman for the school, said in an emailed statement, "Harvard will continue to take steps to protect the rights of our international students and scholars, members of our community who are vital to the university's academic mission and community, and whose presence here benefits our country immeasurably."
So a couple of things here. My first statement for today's roundtable was a kind of a personal note, that I recently had this dental procedure yesterday. And I mentioned that for a reason, to kind of a bookmark this whole discussion, oddly, about Harvard. Because yesterday, I went to our favorite dentist, who's in Cambridge, and as I was having my teeth drilled, my wife walked to Harvard Square, and what she saw, it was graduation yesterday, she saw the infamous doxing truck on Mass Ave. This is a truck that has surveillance capabilities. And it has a kind of a digital placard on the side naming specific students who have supported Palestine. And this is a truck belonging to the organization Accuracy in Media. And one of Trump's allegations is that the university has encouraged or condoned anti-Semitism among its students. Now, it's very unclear to me what the relation is between the putative presence of or prevalence of anti-Semitism on the campus and the presence of international students. And I wanted to ask Malia about this, because one of the things that the Trump administration is doing in insisting on the necessity for barring international students from being allowed to enroll at Harvard is that a disproportionate number of them are Chinese, have affiliations with the Chinese Communist Party, and contribute to the atmosphere of anti-Semitism. I've been following this whole matter very closely as somebody, who has worked on higher education for many years. Malia, I'm not aware of any kind of Venn diagram mapping of Chinese students who belong or have ties to the Communist Party, and Chinese students who are anti-Semitic.
And in fact, many Jews fled to China around World War II. I mean, there's a wonderful sort of history to look at there of how many Jewish people settled in Shanghai and had the sort of the cosmopolitanism of it back then. So it is like that. Those two things don't come together. So I used to work at Harvard. This is a long time ago. I also got my master's degree there. So I've been through commencement at Harvard. And there are two things going on here. One is the Trump administration is specifically targeting Harvard for special terrible treatment. Mm. But this is part of a larger effort to weaken higher education in America overall. Mm. And just to correct a few details, I think the New York Times got a little bit wrong yesterday. So the way commencement at Harvard works, I mean, everyone who's graduating in the morning, all those graduating students gather in Harvard Yard, and they sit with their classmates from whatever school that they are graduating from. And then in the afternoon, they go back to their specific schools, and that's when they get their diplomas. Mm-hmm. But in the morning, when everyone's together in Harvard Yard, all the different schools have something, like each student is given something that sort of represents their school. Mm-hmm. And when the president or whoever addresses those students, they sort of raise it in the air. So if I remember correctly, I think it was Harvard Med School, you know, they have stethoscopes. And so mm-hmm. They'll wave those mm-hmm. in the air. And I went to the Kennedy School.
Except 30 seconds. Go ahead.
And we were given these sort of beach balls that were globes, and the New York Times showed a picture of that yesterday, implying that like this is the first time that they've been given, and that it's about going in specifically against the Trump administration's sort of assault on international students. It's always been an incredibly international place.
We'll hold there. We'll continue. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right. We have a few minutes left with this terrific group this morning on the roundtable panel, and we welcome you back. Malia Dumont, Alexander Mihailovic, and Aaron Pasitti. And I think we're going to go in the opposite order here of Malia was talking, so we're going to let her finish up, and then we'll hear from Alexander and then Aaron. Go, Malia.
Yeah. So aside from the Trump administration's specific targeting of Harvard, ostensibly because Trump just doesn't like anyone standing up to him, and Harvard is the richest and most prominent institution. There has been a more widespread assault on higher education writ large, and specifically against international students. So earlier this week, Marco Rubio announced that all U.S. embassies overseas are pausing all interviews for all international students who are planning to come to the United States and who need visa interviews. This pause, which is indefinite, is so, as it was announced, is so the Department of State can develop new procedures for vetting the social media mm-hmm. of international students who want to come to the United States to make sure that they are acceptable from a Trump administration point of view. So who knows how long this pause is going to last, but that's all international students. That announcement came through on Monday or Tuesday. And then within 24 hours of that, another announcement came through that, again, from Marco Rubio, that the Trump administration is going to aggressively, was the word used, try to minimize the number of Chinese students in the United States as well, and was going to specifically try to prohibit anyone associated with the Chinese Communist Party from coming to the United States to study, or anyone in so-called critical fields. And I think what they were referring to is sort of high-tech science. This is writ large. This is not only Harvard. What they're talking about with Harvard is the university's ability to support all international students. But these other things that were announced this week have the effect of basically prohibiting all American institutions of higher education from welcoming new international students from anywhere. The timing couldn't be worse because the paperwork that is required for students to get visas was sent out by many institutions of higher education just in the past couple weeks because students are trying to get their visas over the summer so they can come to the United States in the fall and study. And just to underscore how important this is, in 2023-24, international students contributed nearly $44 billion to the U.S. economy, supported almost 400,000 jobs, making international education the seventh largest U.S. service export. That's from a statement that the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration released this week in response to these measures that were announced by Marco Rubio. So this is an emergency for American institutions of international education. Harvard has a higher percentage of international students than many, but you know, it's not a small percentage at other universities, especially in the graduate programs. A lot of graduate programs depend on the international students who come in, especially in the sciences, and that isn't a bad thing for the United States. The idea that it's bad for the United States is just ridiculous, and I think if anything, these economic statistics I just shared vastly sort of under quantify the effect. This is like international students that, directly contribute.
That's direct. That's not. The,
yes,
yeah.
That's
doesn't
not all
include
the indirect,
the downstream
like,
and the multiplier
the downstream.
Effects.
I mean, it's enormous. It's enormous.
Yeah, I just wanted to add very quickly to your comments about the writ large character of what the Trump administration is trying to do at Harvard. This is a warning shot to all of American higher education. But there's another dimension of this, which is that if we think about all of American higher education, there's a difference between Harvard and many other institutions from a budgetary point of view, because many institutions, unlike Harvard, which has a very high, my wife yesterday reminded me when we were in Cambridge, Mass, that 28% of the Harvard student body, you know, comes from other places, from foreign countries. But Harvard doesn't rely on its operating budget for tuition. It doesn't draw on the tuition for its operating budget to a significant degree. Other universities and colleges do.
Yeah.
And if you have a significant drop in foreign student enrollments at many other places, that you know
margins are so small.
Margins are so small. You're going to have the possibility that many of these institutions will simply fold.
They were already many of them on the verge of that anyway, coming through COVID, which is a terrible time for American higher education.
Yeah.
And the financial structure of American higher education, especially for the majority of institutions, which don't have the endowment of Harvard.
Right.
I mean, the majority of institutions are like, you know, these small regional liberal arts colleges that may not be well known on the national stage, but they are the center, the cultural center, the lifeblood of their communities, you know, dotted around the country. And a lot of those are endangered.
Yeah. Piggybacking on something Malia said a while ago, the U.S. exports, we have a trade surplus in services. We export financial services, travel, information technology, business services, and education is a big one. So irony is not the word. The head slapping aspect of this is that by barring international students from coming to the U.S., that's going to increase the trade deficit by reducing U.S. exports. Which, remember, the trade deficit was the biggest, the national emergency that justified the tariffs. So this is clearly a wildly, not that anybody was confused about whether Trump was confused about the consistency, but this will increase the U.S. trade deficit, not by a lot, but in terms of, doing things that generate growth for the U.S., this is going to have the opposite effect.
We just have about 2 or 3 minutes, but I'm interested in what you think, Malia. Certainly, as an alum of, we've talked about how this impacts Harvard, but also how this impacts other universities and other colleges throughout the country. But it just seems like, when is this going to end? I mean, it just seems like a death of a thousand cuts, right?
Right. Well, that's. We don't know. That's the problem. And so, one of the things I've been doing as an administrator at Bard is every time some new announcement like this gets, the first thing I do is I call up my, the district office of Senator Gillibrand, Senator Schumer, and Congressman Ryan, and say, this is the new thing that just came down, and this is how it's affecting us, and. If we don't see movement on this, this indefinite pause on any visa interview for international students, we don't see any movement on this in the next week, then we really need you to be pushing for this. I mean, how hard is it? to come up with methods for screening the social media, even no matter how ridiculous you think that is. I mean, that's the other thing of this. There's no way to do due diligence on who's a member of the Chinese Communist Party or not. How are you going to comprehensively review all the social media of international students from around the world, where they have different platforms in different countries? I mean, it's just. You know, I'm trying to continually enlist our political representation to sort of advocate on our behalf and push for there to be a time frame associated with this. But we don't know.
Like a good spousal squabble, sometimes it just isn't about what you think it's about.
Mm, yeah.
Mm. Yep. And then you got to figure out what it is about.
Yeah.
And by that time, you're squabbling about other things.
Mm-hmm.
And away you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he can stretch this fight out with, I mean, Harvard for a long time because they are so wealthy and have lawyers that can handle this. And I think that's the threat that, like you were talking about, the regional colleges and the smaller colleges.
Right. But
the longer this gets drawn out, the more fear that gets instilled amongst the smaller places.
But I think his mistake with Harvard, and one of the reasons I think that he's going to have to backtrack on that specifically, is it is by far the most prestigious American institution overseas. Every son and daughter of a prime minister, or I think that, you know, the crown princess of Belgium, for example, they're admitted to Harvard. And Trump will love to have these people come to him knocking on his door saying, you know, I really need my daughter to be able to go to Harvard. And those are the phone calls that he's getting. And so I don't think he's going to want to say no to the King of Belgium, King of the Belgians. Sorry, that's his technical title.
I love that.
Thank
you
for clarifying that. Yeah,
I only know that because I lived in Belgium for a short time. I think there's going to be all kinds of billionaires from around the world who are going to push to have their sons and daughters able to go to Harvard.
But that's exactly what he wants.
That's exactly
what he wants. Rich people calling him and asking him for favors.
And so it'll be he'll see it as a win for himself. But I think this will have to be rolled back because of that.
I knew the king of the Belgian waffle. His name was Ernie. He lived in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I don't know if Ernie is still with us or not,
potato.
But I'll have to try the king of the Belgian waffle. It's 45 minutes past 10 o'clock. We are out of time. My thanks to our wonderful group this morning, Aaron Alexander and Malia. I thank you so much for your expertise and for sharing it with our audience as we get ready for a fun drive, and just another opportunity to thank all of you and to thank all of our panelists for the wonderful work they do, and to see people support it and to realize that it's something that makes up their day. I thank you for all that you do, and I thank for everyone who will support the efforts. Thank you so much. We'll be back right after this.